Good morning and welcome to the March 3rd, 2026 committee hearing of the Minnesota House Commerce and Finance Policy Committee. There is a quorum present. The first order of business is to approve the minutes from the meeting of February 26th.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Heintzman moves the minutes. Any other corrections, deletions, concerns? Should be Thursday. All right. We should have in the header, second line, it should be Thursday the 26th and not Tuesday the 26th. Representative Heintzman, would you be willing to amend your motion to include that?
I would amend my motion to reflect the correct date.
Thank you, Representative. Any other questions? Seeing none and hearing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes from the meeting of Thursday, February 26th, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the motion prevails. The first bill that we have on the agenda today is House File 3604, and it comes to us by one of our members, Representative Van Binsbergen. And as he makes his way to the testifying table, invite everybody to go ahead and locate the bill. Good morning, Representative Van Binsbergen. And since you are a member of the committee, what I think we'll do is we'll move the bill before us, House File 3604, and you have an author's amendment. Is that correct in the A1?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair.
And the nature of your A1 amendment is a technical correction, as I understand it?
That's correct.
And did you want to move your A1 to the 3604?
Please.
All right, Representative Van Binsbergen moves the A1 to House File 3604 to get the bill in the shape the author wishes. Any discussion? Hearing none and seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails. Representative Van Binsbergen, to your bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a rather simple bill. It modifies statute for bulk delivery of non-oxygenated fuel. Commonly, it's the fuel that's used in small engines like snowmobiles and motorcycles and boats. The bill allows the fuel to be delivered directly to the vehicles. Boat owners who don't have access to marinas have limited options to refill their watercraft. So, you know, their options are to use large on-site storage tanks that are, so they use these large water tanks, and they also use containers in 6-gallon containers, and they transport them back and forth to the gas station. And the other option is to actually pull their boat out of the water to refill their tank, and that's a problem often as well, because you know they got to travel, and not all gas stations have got the right type of fuel. There is a number of boat facilities that want companies that want to get into this business of watercraft directly filling watercraft directly, and you know, instead they're having to use these large expansive tanks. This bill will allow, like I said, direct delivery to the watercraft. So that is the makeup of the bill. I don't know if there's any questions.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Binsberg. I didn't realize this was problematic, but as you're explaining it, and nice job explaining it, you're exactly right. Like, places like Vermilion only have one option to fuel in, and there's no market on this lake just for that issue. It's basically they have to go there and pay whatever dollar amount, which is fine, that's free market, but I think this would be in plus. The old firefighter in me brings up how we're moving this stuff around, and this totally is open for leaks and all sorts of stuff by our water, by some of the containers people put them in. So, Mr. Chair, I think this is a great bill. I hope we get it going.
Thank you. Representative Binsberg, comments?
Thank you, Mr. Hewitt. I appreciate that. I think you're right on. You know, also I see this as you got a lot of people in the lakes. Summer is short, and their time is short, and they're transporting their boats back and forth to get fuel in them. I think this bill makes a lot of sense and a time constraint as well for people that you know, want to have get their boats filled by a company that comes in and directly fills their tank.
Representative Heinzman, and I do will, after Representative Heinzman, I'm just going to check and see if there's any public testimony on the bill, and we'll go back to Member Cautious. But Representative Heinzman, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, there's another, I think, unintended positive here. Anytime you're moving boats out of a lake, which is frequently the case with large tanks and high costs of fuel or maybe unavailable fuel on some lakes without a resort or what have you, you could be transporting AIS, plugging up the boat landing, just moving the boat to refuel. There's a lot of positives here. I'm glad that you're bringing your bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Heinzman. Is there any member of the public who would like to testify on the bill this morning? Anyone from the public? Seeing none, Representative Cagle.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Van Bindensberg, I'm sorry, that's a mouthful.
We gave him that bill so he could practice.
Yeah, I'm trying, you know. It'll by the end of the session, I'll get it. You know, one of the unintended consequences I fear you're overlooking is forcing kids to get out and paddle to the dock when we run out of gas.
Okay, good point.
No, but I recognize this problem. Maybe just one thing to think about is how we incorporate best practices into kind of the business side and see how, you know, just to mitigate some of the spills and stuff, if we can just kind of educate folks on the best way to do it, I think that would be really helpful. Yeah. So thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry. Any other member questions? Representative Van Bindensberg, and I know that we've been working on this. This was a bill that we were hoping would have come last year with the other fuel bills that we were doing, which you carried. And I know that we've contacted the DNR, we've contacted the Department of Commerce, and you're still in conversations with some of the folks at the State Fire Marshal's office on a few open questions. And what I think we'll probably do is lay this bill over until we get clarification from the State Fire Marshal's office on this, and then the committee will address their comments, whatever they may be, and then take the appropriate action on the bill. Are you okay with that today, Representative Van Bindensbergen?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding. Good. There's a little work to be done here yet.
All right, with that, we will lay over House File 3604, pending some additional information for the committee's benefit, and that is as amended. Thank you. And at this time, I'm going to turn the gavel over to Representative Perryman, who is one of our vice chairs, and I have the next bill, House File 2236, which I will move before the committee, and I'll also ask to have that bill laid over. So as we move, we'll be ready to go here momentarily.
Good morning, Representative Chair Ojusko. Do you would move HF 2236 before the committee with intent to lay the bill over?
Madam Chair, that is my motion.
We have the bill before us. Representative Ojusko, to your bill.
This committee, as well as other committees, oftentimes will have multiple single subject items that the committee's been working on, and we put those into what's called an omnibus bill or a mini bill with the different things that the committee is working on. This bill will be one of those bills for the topics that we're working on. I know that the Department of Commerce is also bringing forward a technical bill that they're going to be working on. That may also be a bill that we use for future business of the committee, and that is the purpose of this bill, is to make available for the committee's use a bill that ties back to state statute on the things that we're working on. Before the committee, if needed as a vehicle bill to pass out and to move forward any kind of omnibus activity this committee is looking to do. And that is the extent of the purpose and the motion of this bill.
Thank you, Chair Ojusko. Do we have any testifiers? We do not have any testifiers signed up, but do we have any individuals in the audience that would like to testify? Anyone in the audience that would like to testify? Seeing none, we'll go right to the members. Members, do we have any questions for Chair Ojusko? Seeing none, we have talked about it, and
I believe that Chair Cagle.
I'm sorry, Chair Cagle.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Ojeskel. Just want to encourage my members to vote yes.
Any further discussion? Hearing none. Final comments, Chair Ojeskel.
Again, it's for the future use in this committee if needed for the work that we've been doing pretty well together on this session so far. So. Madam Chair, motion to lay over 2236 for possible future consideration by the committee.
And with that, Representative Ojeskel renews his motion that House File 2236 be laid over for possible inclusion.
The next bill in front of the committee is House File 3709 by Representative Perryman. And as Representative Perryman is the chief author, and we've also got our very own Representative Elkins, who is going to be, is a co-author on this bill. And they are both vice chairs of the committee. So that's worth noting here this morning as well. And so I will move House File 3709 before the committee. In that motion that it be re-referred to the General Register if it is the wishes of this committee. So, Representative Perryman, with that, we will defer to you for House File 3709.
Excuse me. Thank you, Chair Ojeskel. House File 3709 is about ensuring that Minnesota-based financial institutions are,
Yes, you're a little early.
We do like punctuality, though.
I'm confused right now. Let's continue. House File 3709 is about ensuring that Minnesota-based financial institutions are allowed to evolve alongside their customers and members, rather than forcing Minnesotans to rely on unregulated, out-of-state, or offshore providers for services that are already in use today. The legislation before allows banks and credit unions to offer custodial accounts for digital assets, basically a safe deposit box for digital assets like cryptocurrencies. In my district, as probably many of yours, banks and credit unions play a critical role for our constituents. They are trusted, relationship-based institutions that know their customers personally. As digital assets and virtual currencies become more mainstream, consumers are already asking familiar questions. Can my local financial institution help me safeguard these assets? Can I work with someone I trust? Can I do this under Minnesota law and oversight? HF 3709 answers those questions responsibly. This bill does not push financial institutions, Representative Elkins.
No, this is still yours.
This bill does not push financial institutions in speculative activity. Instead, it allows them, if they choose, to provide custody and safekeeping services under rigorous financial security and integrity standards overseen by federal and state regulators. In short, the standards regarding cryptocurrency are the same as for other types of assets safeguarded by credit unions. Institutions must maintain written policies addressing risk management, cybersecurity, internal controls, and business continuity, and they must notify the Department of Commerce before offering these services.
So that framework matters.
Representative Elkins.
Yeah, thank you.
Go ahead.
It ensures innovation happens here under Minnesota's regulatory supervision rather than outside it. House File 3709 also helps level the playing field. Without this authority, large national or non-bank entities will dominate this space, while local institutions, despite being more trusted by consumers, are sidelined. The bill ensures that Minnesota consumers can continue to rely on the same local institutions they already trust for mortgages, small business lending, and financial guidance. At its core, 3709 is about choice, consumer protection, and competitiveness. It allows Minnesota financial institutions to respond to changing customer expectations while preserving safety, transparency, accountability Minnesotans expect. For communities like the ones I represent and for many Minnesotans who want innovation without sacrificing trust, this bill strikes the right balance. So I respectfully ask for your support for House File 3709.
Representative Elkins, thank you. We do have a couple of testifiers on the bill, and the first one will be Sam Smith, Government Affairs Director for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Mr. Smith, you make your way to the testifying table, please. Good morning, sir, and welcome. You'll state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Co-chairs O'Driscoll and Cagle, members of the committee, my name is Sam Smith, and I'm here to testify briefly on House File 3709 on behalf of the Department of Commerce. The department appreciates that many Minnesotans value virtual currencies, and we support efforts to incorporate virtual currency into our regulatory framework where appropriate. House File 3709 levels the playing field and allows Minnesotans to safely keep their virtual currencies with a trusted community partner like a credit union or bank. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. And we will, any questions of Mr. Smith from the committee? Seeing none, hearing none, we have two individuals. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Smith, how, excuse me, how will the, how would this, these assets interact with lost property?
Mr. Smith.
Chair O'Driscoll, Chair Cagle, unfortunately, our unclaimed property statute is currently silent on virtual currencies. We do have legislation that we are in the process of introducing that would incorporate unclaimed property into our statute for that very reason, because we know it is a valued asset that many people hold, and it is a priority of the department to have a statutory regime to accept that virtual currency and hold it for the rightful owner.
Representative Cagle, follow up. With Mr. Smith, it's slightly off topic, but since it was brought up in a kind of a sidecar way, will we be seeing a department bill anytime soon from your agency that may include the virtual currency stuff you just talked about?
Mr. Chair Driscoll, yes. I'm hopeful that the bill jackets will be arriving imminently, but we have shared our draft language widely with many community partners, continue to have conversations about the legislation, and hope to work on it this session.
Very good. Thank you. With that, our next testifier is Ryan Smith from the Minnesota Credit Union Network, and he is joining us this morning via Zoom. Mr. Smith, are you there?
I am indeed, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
Introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Happy to. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ryan Smith. I'm here on testifying virtually on behalf of the Minnesota Credit Union Network. And I want to, I'm going to keep my comments brief, not least of which because my voice is basically shot. But I do want to just thank Representative Perryman, Representative Elkins for all their work. I also want to thank the Department of Commerce for input on the bill. We have worked with them very closely on the language throughout the process. We really feel that this bill strikes the right balance of making sure that local financial institutions have the option to hold these digital assets in custodial accounts and help local banks and credit unions maintain relevancy in a really changing marketplace. So with that, Mr. Chair, I don't have a lot of comments other than to say that we think the bill is a really good one. We worked closely with the departments. We worked with our colleagues over in the banks, and we think that this is a responsible step forward for Minnesota consumers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. We do have one question from Chair Cagle, I believe.
Thank you, Chair Cagle. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Smith, I was just curious if these crypto deposits would be NCUA backed at all?
Mr. Smith?
Chair O'Driscoll, Chair Cagle, yes. Thank you for the question. No, they wouldn't be. They're just held in custodial accounts. I think the easiest way to describe these would basically you would consider these like as a safety deposit box for digital assets. So, and like safety deposit box, any items in a safety deposit box, they are not insured by the NCUA.
Thank you.
Representative Cagle, follow up? Okay. Mr. Smith, we'll ask you to stand by in case there are other questions as we move along. And we have Mr. Smith from the Department of Commerce, Mr. Smith from the credit unions. And to prove that you don't have to be Smith to testify, the next person will be Chase Larson. And he will also be joining us via Zoom. And he, I believe, is with the St. Cloud Financial Credit Union. And with that, Mr. Larson, are you there?
Good morning, Chair. I am.
Mr. Larson, if you would go ahead and state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Chase Larson. I'm with St. Cloud Financial Credit Union, where I'm the Executive Vice President and Chief Lending Officer. I've had the pleasure over the last 4.5 years to lead our credit union's digital asset strategy. And I think just to echo what's already been said, the bill in front of you today is not about cryptocurrency hype. It's about consumer protection and ensuring that our local financial institutions and local credit unions remain relevant. We've started, in 2023, we started measuring the deposit outflows to exchanges that are not in our state. In 2023, it was $1 million in liquidity. In 2024, it was approximately $5.2 million. And last year, it was over $15 million of liquidity leaving our local community. And so I think this is about relevancy. It's about ensuring that that liquidity has a path back into our local economy and ultimately about consumer protection.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Larson. Any questions for Mr. Larson this morning? From members. Seeing none,
Chair,
Mr. Larson, go ahead.
Chair, can I just add one more comment to Chair Kegel's question? As Mr. Smith stated, these are not NCUA insured. However, there are a lot of institutions that are getting private insurance through companies such as Lloyd's of London. Not dollar for dollar, but more for protection against loss of keys, hack, et cetera.
All right. Representative Smith, I do see a pattern, though, developing here this morning.
Thank you, Chair. There's been so much from my extended family that I thought I should say something. the last testifier did touch on a question I have about this bill, and I've talked to the credit unions about this. So the last testifier mentioned liquidity going out into exchanges, which I understand something of a concern. However, from other testifiers, I've heard this described as a digital lockbox. And my understanding of lockboxes is they're not generally part of bank liquidity. The assets in there are shut off from the bank, except maybe, I guess, fees help with cash flow. So I guess those two reasons don't connect to me of why this would be necessary. Now, that's a maybe general question, maybe not for the witness, maybe one of the bill authors. But I can restate that if that's not clear, but I'm somewhat confused about those two things being connected in this bill.
Representative Smith, I think we'll have you restate the question. We'll go to Mr. Larson because I had the opportunity to visit with them as well.
Okay.
And they were talking about two issues, but I'll let Mr. Larson talk about those, and I think that might help for clarification.
Okay.
So if you'll just restate the question.
Sure. This bill doesn't seem to help credit union liquidity at all because it creates a digital lockbox where people can keep their cryptocurrency, but that cryptocurrency is not going to be part of the actual assets of the bank, as far as I understand. Lockbox is generally working. So I'm hoping that someone can connect the need for it in the sense of needing our credit unions to continue to have liquidity, while also the actual assets that are in these accounts will not be part of the bank's credit profile.
Sure. Mr. Larson, did you understand the question?
I did.
Then we'll go ahead and give you a shot at answering Representative Smith's question. Proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Representative Smith, today I see this as relevancy and consumer protection. I think the thought over time is that we will see an ever-changing landscape. And so I think today it's about staking the claim of relevancy with our members. And keeping up with these competing exchanges. If you look at the cryptocurrency exchanges across our country, they're filing for bank charters.
We now have Walmart that's settling in Bitcoin, and we have Visa and MasterCard connecting with these digital asset or cryptocurrency exchanges. And so I think it may not represent liquidity on the balance sheet today, but it does represent relevancy and consumer protection in our state.
Representative Smith.
Yeah, that's a helpful question. Thank you for clarifying. I ask because one of the concerns I have is with the volatility of cryptocurrency, that if credit unions are turning into exchanges, which I have a problem with, as the testifier mentioned, some of these national exchanges becoming bank services, I do think that's a problem. I just don't think we should have our credit unions acting as exchanges, which this bill does not do, I want to clarify, but that's why my question was focused in on that. So I'll be voting yes on this bill. I think it's fine for people to keep their digital private keys at a credit union and to keep relevancy, but I think we have to be careful of even what was mentioned there of potential, I don't know what you call it, leakage into potential exchange services, which I think in the volatility of that market would put some of our small credit unions at risk.
Thank you, Representative Smith. As we know from previous bills we've had, that cryptocurrency and ATM style machines and things are in the focus of this committee. And again, without belaboring the point, but with Mrs. Guthrie's disappearance, and that's kind of off the front page of the news, but that was a give us money through a crypto wallet and the like. So this is stuff that not only do we as state regulators need to get on top of, but it's going to have some national and federal oversight as well. And we can only do what we can do here in Minnesota. So with that, any other member questions? Representative Hinke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, bill authors. I also am trying to get my mind around some of these issues. In our previous conversation that we had about the ATMs and the systems, there was some remarks about them making crypto available to the unbanked, right? And it is my understanding that crypto is part of crypto's appeal, is that it is not in the traditional banking system. And that comment, you know, it's been roiling around in my head about how we're like allowing unbanked people to interact with the crypto exchange. And when I think about this, I was thinking about the lockbox, safety deposit box metaphor, right? Because a safety deposit box doesn't help me avoid being scammed. It's just a place where I put something. If I buy something that I believe is valuable and I put it in a safety deposit box and it has no value anymore, it's just sitting there, right? And nobody's going to help protect me from having been scammed in the first place. And so I guess I'm just concerned by that these conversations that we're having, how they're all going to intersect. The previous testifier in response to Representative Smith's question said, it sounds like this is just as much about keeping credit unions relevant as it is about helping consumers. And like, I don't know that keeping banks relevant is really like the objective we should be pursuing. We should be pursuing helping people manage and not be scammed by crypto, right? So I don't really have a specific question. I'm interested to see what the agency brings. I think that there is just like multiple things going on here. And if at the end of the day, we're saying, put your lockbox here because banks want more business because they're losing relevancy, that's not necessarily something that I'm comfortable moving as a policy goal. Banks should be, people should use the bank, right? Credit unions are great. I've used credit union forever. But it's like, is that our objective, like the relevancy of the banking industry? I don't know. There's just many things kind of being pulled at here. And we're doing policy in an area that's brand new, and I don't want to chase them in a way that's going to make us not helping actual people, but like helping the banking industry.
And Representative Finke, as I mentioned to Representative Smith, I had the opportunity to meet with Mr. Larson and some other folks in the St. Cloud Financial Credit Union. And they had talked about customers coming in asking, do you have a crypto option? So when we're talking about being relevant, I think they're losing deposits to other organizations and other places that have this. And they want to be able to have the digital keys to be able to keep those assets and to protect people. As a matter of fact, the CEO of the organization told me at one time he got a call on a Sunday morning from a customer who was being scammed. And because they had that closer connection with the consumer, they were actually able to fort a fraudulent situation of someone going after crypto. And so that was where this bill came from, was to try to provide that extra layer of protection for people who are already using those. And if they don't have that level of comfort and security, those deposits are going to go somewhere else in a crypto form. And I think that's what he means by relevant. We could certainly ask him if I'm hot, cold, or way off base on this. And I think I will do that. Mr. Larson, did I explain that close to correctly?
Chair, you're spot on. We've surveyed our members over the last several years. We're a 28,000 member financial cooperative. We're member owned, not for profit, and 20% on average, 20% of our members own digital assets. And with these exchanges, there's nobody to call. There's no Chase to go in to see on a Tuesday when you have questions. And so when I say relevant, it's about serving our members and member protection.
Senator, thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and to the testifier. So I think that's very helpful to me, right? Because these aren't lockboxes, right? Like, this is an opportunity to have people in the financial institution help you through the process of engaging with crypto, right? That to me is just a different, like, if I might be getting scammed and I call my bank, my lockbox isn't going to help me, right? Like, these are financial institutions supporting customers through this process, through this. I mean, I admit I'm asking these questions as a person who has no interest in crypto and doesn't think it's a good thing for the future of our world. So I'm trying to make sure that people understand, like, are they going to get the help that they need? Are they going to be able to access real support, or are they just putting something in another box that may or may not have value when they come back and look at it?
You know, great question. I think this is step one in trying to provide that level of protection. And as Mr. Smith from the Commerce Department had mentioned, and as we've been working on as a committee, sometimes the scamsters, well, no, not sometimes, the scamsters move faster than the regulators can to stop this and get in front of them. And so this is a step, I believe, to try to get to that end game. Thank you, Representative. Thank you. Representative Elkins.
Yeah. I would say, I like Representative Finke, I have absolutely no interest in speculating in cryptocurrency. But if I did, I think my credit union is a place where I would want to stash it. You know, if anything happened to me, they would have all of the account information. I think so much cryptocurrency is just orphaned out in the ether because somebody lost their account keys or they died without passing it on, their account keys on to their heirs. So. I agree, this is a very marginal step in the right direction, but it's helpful.
Very good. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, for one, am really glad you came forward with this bill 3709, kind of a digital safety deposit box. I had an uncle that worked within the banking industry had a 50-plus year career in that, going all the way back to the PCA days. And it was interesting to hear him talk about stories about when they had to open up safety deposit boxes and whatnot and help people go through that. And the amount of paper stocks that they would find, and people bought stock in certain companies and whatnot. Some of them are worth something. Some of those stocks never materialized anything. The idea that the bank was a great holding location to be able to protect that particular asset for those individuals that decided to take their assets and diversify them among whatever it may be. And now for us nowadays, people are deciding to diversify among cryptocurrency. This is just basically I look at this nothing more than a digital safety deposit box that banks are allowed to be able to give their customers as another resource to be able to protect or give them some semblance of protection over, you know, or whatever they decide to buy when it comes to Bitcoin or whatever it may particularly be. So thank you for bringing this forward. I think it does serve an exceptionally good purpose. And I think having that face-to-face interaction that banks have when people are doing their regular business, I think, is just another safety check that we have in the system in order to be able to make sure people are not getting scammed in the process. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Bach.
Fadamiyaye, thank you. Okay, forgive my ignorance. This is a whole new world to me, the crypto. How is the, and you may have already answered this, and again, my apologies if you have, how are the customers protected more using a kiosk or something at a bank than they are at a actual stand-up kiosk somewhere else?
Great question, Representative Buck, and I think Mr. Larson is probably the best one to answer that question. I don't think it involves a kiosk like we were talking earlier, but I'm going to let Mr. Larson enlighten the committee on that. Mr. Larson.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Today, when you purchase, we'll just say Bitcoin or any cryptocurrency, but for the sake of conversation, I'm going to say Bitcoin. When you buy Bitcoin on Coinbase or any exchange, the issue is consumers are not reading the fine print. If they did, they would understand that they have an IOU from the exchange. They don't actually own the asset because they don't hold the underlying key. When they transfer it in into, we'll say, our credit union's digital safety deposit box, it is a member self-custody solution, so they're taking ownership of that actual asset. The only other way for a consumer to truly own their Bitcoin or cryptocurrency would be cold storage. And a lot of everyday individuals are not using cold storage devices. So this allows them, it's as easy as sending an ACH. There's a, you send it from the exchange with a private, or I'm sorry, public receiving address. Those assets move on the blockchain and the private key would come into their digital safety deposit box, allowing them to take self-custody or ownership of those assets.
Mm-hmm. Representative Bach.
I think I'm done.
And just for clarification, the term that Mr. Larson used, ACA, is automated cash handling. And that's oftentimes used, like with employers, to bank accounts for employees for payroll, or if you move from one outside account to another outside account, that goes to what's called the ACA exchange or system. Representative Cha.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Pierre Elkins, for bringing this forward. I think it's a step in the right direction. You're taking the Kia. You know, I mean, you go to the gas station, there's a kiosk in the corner, you know, in the very dark corner of a gas station versus going into your local credit union. So I think this is a new frontier, but I do think that this bill is going in the right direction, and I'm looking forward to see what else we have. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Cha. Representative Van Binsbergen. And before you go ahead, Representative Perry, we're going to have you move over one seat. We have been got information from IT Media that that mic has seen better days and it's not picking up for the general public. So
you mean I'm not loud enough?
I don't know what the case is, okay. But we need to have you move. Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question of clarification. So this is for co-ops, not regular banks, that can be involved in this, right, that have these digital lockboxes. And just also one other question is,
Banks and
credit unions.
Excuse me?
Banks and credit unions.
Okay. And what's kind of a ballpark cost to the consumer? I realize every institution is going to have a different set of rate, but do you have a ballpark idea?
I think that's a Mr. Larson question again.
Mr. Larson, did you understand Representative Van Binsbergen's question? He's questioning what kind of fees or charges a consumer may have at the, or a member, I should say, at the credit union or a customer at a bank may expect to incur by having this digital lockbox and having you participate in holding the assets for folks.
Thank you, Chair. I think it depends on the. I think it'll depend on the institution. Our cost structure is going to be a percentage based on the average monthly value with a minimum of $5, maximum of $25. The goal here is member service and member participation, but that's our range.
Representative Van Binsbergen. Representative Smith, and then we're going to see if there's anybody from the public that has any other questions for the committee. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Driscoll. I spoke maybe like a little some concerns about this bill earlier, but I did want to speak in support of it. I do own cryptocurrency, and I think this is a good idea to have some sort of digital lockbox for credit unions. And maybe just like some basic like cryptocurrency stuff I think is important. So The blockchain technology, the basic idea is that there is a public ledger that everyone is available, right? There's a public key that everyone can see. But when you're buying cryptocurrency, you're getting access to a private key. That's what gives you access to the value of that thing in the public ledger. That's the technology that this is a part of. But as one of our testifiers said, when you buy on the exchanges, most of them like Coinbase, you're buying not the private key itself, you're buying access to the private key that you can use for value purchases. But it's always staying within the exchanges. So if those exchanges fail, or you no longer have access, or you're locked out, like happened with Robinhood, or very early on, Mt. Gox, you just lose that asset if those exchanges fail. It's very hard legally to recover any sort of asset. So what the credit unions are saying is you can take that private key and then just put it in a credit union, not like selling it to the credit union to get the money, but the private key is there. So I do think it provides some protection there, and while I'm concerned of maybe some exchange creep, so to speak, that we might be concerned about, I do think this is a good bill, and I think it's a good service that credit unions can offer Minnesotans.
Representative Smith, before I go to public testimony, and this is a serious question, you said you own crypto. Did you use a kiosk to buy it? And I don't mean that to be, and I absolutely don't mean that to be hilarious because you're talking about it. I'm just wondering, because I'm not in that world, and
I don't mind saying I used the exchange Coinbase, which I think is the most popular one in North America.
Okay, thank you. Just like I said, just out of curiosity, since we're kind of tying a number of things together here this morning.
I actually, after we had the hearing on Tuesday, I kind of made a mental note to maybe like try one of those. I haven't yet, but I just to see what the experience is like. But I have not yet, so I'll report back to you.
Yes, I was going to say we'll check with Chair Kegel, and as soon as you tell her, then you can tell everybody what's happened here. So that's a serious question. I'm just curious, and if you're, as you can see, not a lot of us are venturing into that, and it could be because of, well, I won't get into that, maybe many different things. But is there any member of the public who wishes to testify on the matter before the committee? House File 3709. Anyone wishing to testify on 3709? Seeing none, hearing none. Any other member questions this morning? Seeing none, we'll toss it to our co-authors, Representatives Perryman and Representative, I'm sorry. Representative Cagle. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to thank the authors. I do think this is a good idea. I'm coming at it as a way of actually maybe getting people into more traditional products. And so if they are unbanked and crypto is kind of their first forte into walking into a credit union or a bank, I think that's an opportunity for the bank staff or credit union staff to educate those folks on more traditional products and get them into a more banked situation. I used to work at a nonprofit that administered FAME programs, and so I know how important, you know, kind of building those that credit and account history is. And so I'm hoping that, you know, it's a way to get people in there. And my brilliant LA who has been working on this issue, Alex Wheeler over here, texted me and said maybe we could add a disclosure to some of these crypto transactions, just saying like this transaction may be irreversible, so people kind of, you know, think before they purchase these things. So it's a new world we're working in right now, and so all the ideas are ones that we really kind of have to chew on here. So thank you very much.
And then with that, we'll go to our bill authors and our co-vice chairs, which someone texted me and said that if you have co-vice chairs presenting, are they also known as the vice squad? I don't know. I'm just asking. Representative Perryman.
Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll, Chair Cagle, and members. Really appreciated that vice squad comment I had in my mind, but I was going to use it on the next bill, but you stole my thunder. Yeah. I just want to thank you for your attention, and you can see this is a continuing journey. We're bringing it up again and again, so this is really consumer protection, and it's keeping people safe with their investments and assets in banking and in the credit union, and I really truly appreciate the level of protection this bill can bring to customers who choose to get into the cryptocurrency. And I also want to thank my co-author here, Representative Elkins. We do fist bumps really well, don't we? Yeah. So thank you, and I'll let you have the final words.
Representative Elkins.
Mr. Chair, I want to thank Representative Smith for his illuminating questions. So he probably knows more from a firsthand perspective about this than anybody else in the room. But no, this is definitely a small step in the right direction and a very positive alternative to using the kiosk in my local Haskins liquor store. So yeah, this is a good bill.
Thank you. And with that, I renew the motion that House File 3709 be moved to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? The motion prevails, and it is on its way. Members and members of the audience, we are going to do a little bit of shuffle up here. We're going to go to House File 2400 next. We may have an administrative issue that we're looking into on the other bill that may change what we do with that, but I want to make sure that if we can get it resolved, that'd be great. Otherwise, we will address that bill when we get to it. So House File 2400, and as Representative Hewitt is coming to the testifying table, I am a co-author on this bill. And members, this is a bill that we had heard last year in committee. And it was laid over. And since that time, there's been some additional folks who have looked at this bill. And I was asked if we could bring it back for one more time for conversation. And so that is what we are doing. And so Representative Hewitt, what we are going to do is I think we're going to lay this bill over on 2400, regardless of what action we eventually take with it. But we want to talk about it today and see if we can get some of that peace in the valley on this bill. And so with that, I move House File 2400 in front of the committee to be laid over for future consideration. And with that, Representative Hewitt, you are on, sir.
Well, thank you, Chair Driscoll and members. This is an exciting bill on appraisal. I'm glad that the chair left me 60 minutes to get it to you so you get this information.
Representative Hewitt, you have not 60 minutes.
So both the chair and I know that real estate's a complicated world, and this is one of the worlds that actually in the appraisal, we all try to keep an arm's length with our appraisal on the projects or on the houses that we buy or sell. And this appraisal foundation is one of the nation's leading organizations for real estate. And I always like I do the accountancy bills, which are also exciting. When the appraisers are trying to regulate themselves for their credibility and for what they think is best, I always think that's the best way to go about it. And I think Minnesota has some of the best appraisers in the country. I might not agree with them all the time, but the truth of the matter is that that's the way it's supposed to work. So I'm going to let our testifier here explain the bill a little bit more and explain why you want this.
Mr. Miller, welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me okay? Mm-hmm. Does anybody want to hear me? That's the other question. All right. Thank you, co-chairs Cagle and O'Driscoll, and other members of the committee. My name is Byron Miller, and I am a Minnesota certified residential appraiser, past chair of the Minnesota Real Estate Appraiser Advisory Board, which is also known as REAB. I'm in the immediate past member of the Appraisal Foundation's Appraisal Qualifications Board, which is responsible for setting state guidelines for appraisal qualifying education and continuing education in the United States and its five territories. I'm also currently secretary of the Appraisal Foundation's Advisory Council, twice president and chair of the Minnesota Government Relations Committee of the North Star Chapter of the Appraisal Institute. I appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning on behalf of this bipartisan bill, HF 2400, and I would like to thank Representatives O'Driscoll and Hewitt, as well as other authors, for forwarding this important piece of legislation. If you're not familiar with this bill, I'd like to give you a little background on the issues it addresses. At each quarterly meeting, REAB board members are presented with sanction actions against appraisers from the previous quarter. Currently, the Minnesota Department of Commerce processes complaints against real estate appraisers. There have been numerous inquiries from the public and the board regarding what appears to be inconsistent enforcement by the Department of Commerce. Now, in their defense, the Department of Commerce cannot comment on the specifics of cases due to data privacy issues. However, the lack of additional information to the public and board members questions gives the appearance of a lack of transparency in the enforcement process. HF 2400 would require the Department of Commerce to adopt the Voluntary Disciplinary Action Matrix, or VDAM, for imposing disciplinary actions on appraisers. VDAM was jointly developed by the Appraisal Foundation and the Association of Appraisal Regulatory Officials to provide clear and consistent process for evaluating appraiser infractions. VDAM is a voluntary reference tool that informs the best practices around disciplinary actions while affording states to impose greater or lesser discipline based on the facts or circumstances of each case. Adoption of VDAM provides a greater measure of transparency to the enforcement process than it currently exists. Parties wanting to see how an enforcement decision is made may refer to the VDAM. Its rules-based process allows users to follow the flowchart from the offense to the disciplinary action so they have a better understanding of what to expect if they find themselves accused of such an infraction. REAB supports the HF 2400, and I ask for your support as well. In summary, the adoption of HF 2400 provides greater transparency and an understanding for the Department of Commerce actions and alleviates concerns regarding inconsistencies of enforcement. I'd like to thank you for your attention in this matter, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Brill. I think we're going to have you stand by. We'll bring up Mr. Smith from the department and then take another public testimony, and then we'll get to member discussion. So just ask you to hang tight.
Mr. Chair, can you hear me?
Hewitt. I believe we've got that resolved from when we switched bills. Tech was in, so I think we're good.
Okay, our page asked me to test the mic, so.
Sounds good. Mr. Smith, welcome to the committee again. If you'll proceed with your testimony on House File 2400.
Co-chairs O'Driscoll and Cagle, members of the committee, my name is Sam Smith, and I'm here to provide some remarks on this legislation on behalf of the Department of Commerce. In our investigations with appraisers, we use the factors in Minnesota Statutes 14.045 Subdivision 3 when weighing penalties. This is not just used for appraisal investigations, it's used in all investigations, not just those in commerce. We are audited every 2 years by the appraisal subcommittee. One thing the ASC considers is consistency in property enforcement actions. The department has never been cited by the ASC for inconsistency. The voluntary matrix referenced in this legislation is 69 pages long and, from our perspective, would make enforcement actions and investigations more complicated. It does not define a small fine, medium fine, or any other potential penalties, and we worry that this will not provide any additional clarity. While this legislation does allow for the department to use mitigating factors as listed in the voluntary matrix, the matrix also lists aggravating factors that apply to investigations. The department will also not be able to cherry-pick provisions in the matrix when making a decision. If adopted, the impact of this policy would likely result in more severe penalties for violations by appraisers. Finally, we are not aware of any other state that has codified or mandated the use of the voluntary matrix in this manner, although we do know that some use it as a guide. With this in mind, our goal is to take a balanced approach to protect the marketplace, promote fairness, and be consistent in our enforcement actions, and we take that responsibility seriously. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Is there anyone from the public who wishes to testify on the matter before the committee? House File 2400. Anyone from the public wishing to testify? Seeing none and hearing none, members, questions for Mr. Smith or Mr. Miller or the author of the bill? Representative Cha.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks, Representative, for bringing this forward. I was in the industry when the market crashed in 2008, right? And it was important to note that appraisers during that time were being shopped. Being shopped meaning, you know, if I didn't get the appraisal I wanted, I went to the next appraiser, to get to the appraisal that I needed to close my property. That happened a lot, and that's not the whole of the market crash of 2008, but that's partial. So I think the accountability is important, so thank you for bringing this forward.
Representative Cha, was that more of a background statement, or did you want one of the gentlemen to respond to that?
It was just to support the bill. Thank you.
Yep, gotcha. Other member questions or concerns at this point? Again, My advice to Mr. Miller and to Mr. Smith, since this is back, and I know that more appraisal groups have put their support behind this, Mr. Miller, but I do strongly encourage you to work with the department. We're bringing this up, laying it over, based on the fact that there is more support, it seems like, from the broader industry on this, and to see if there's a way that the department and you are able to come to a well-used term around here, peace in the valley, to see, and we've got some time to consider that later on this session. But again, wanted to get that matter before folks and see if there's any way that we can do some middle ground or an improvement in that investigative and disciplinary process for appraisers here in the state of Minnesota. And with that, Representative Hewitt, we will give you the final word.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think you summed it up where I'd like to go with this, and I appreciate that. And I also, I don't know if I'll be before you again, but I really appreciate your work over the years, especially when I came into the House and we both identified each other as realtors, and we found common ground. So I'd like to thank you for that, and thank you for trusting me with some bills.
Thank you. And you know what? You didn't even need 60 minutes, Representative Hewitt. Right? You're doing great. You're doing good. Left us some time for the last bill. And with that, I will lay over House File 2400 for future consideration by the committee. And again, Mr. Smith, Mr. Miller, and others, I would strongly encourage see if there is a way that we can get to that, because the committee, second time we've heard it, and trying to get to a happy spot for everybody on here. Thank you, gentlemen. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
With that, we will go back to House File 3766, which I did say we were going to put on pause for just a moment. And again, this is another Representative Perryman and Elkins bill. And if you are of a certain generation, a Lewis and Martin feature. Very few people laugh at that anymore, because, and I appreciate, because both our co-authors knew exactly who I was talking about. So with that, we are going to move 3766 before the committee and lay it over, because we understand there may be a possible fiscal note question on here, and we do not want to move bills out of this committee until they are fully vetted and we've got them as clean as we can from what we need to do here. So with that, we are going to lay the bill over, but we're certainly going to have the full hearing on it, and we'll take the fiscal consideration into account when we learn more about that, which probably won't be today. So with that, Representative Perryman, the bill is before the committee, and I'll go ahead as the chief author and have you present the bill.
Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll, and again, I want to thank my bipartisan author here for HF 3766, Representative Elkins. The bill creates a framework for regulating travel insurance in Minnesota. Travel insurance is a discretionary product that provides peace of mind by providing coverage for the financial losses that can occur while traveling, such as, have you ever lost a delayed bag, or you lost a bag, or a last-minute trip cancellation, or a medical emergency overseas. Those are some issues that travel insurance would be discretionary about. Last year, over 1 million Minnesotans chose to purchase travel insurance. Travel insurance also provides non-insurance services like access to 24/7 global assistance services that can help travelers with everything from replacing a lost passport to arranging medical treatment in an emergency and providing translation services at a foreign clinic. Very helpful services. So I just before I turn it over to my co-author, I just would like to share a quick story with you, a real-world example that I heard of how travel insurance works. A consumer was traveling in Italy when they suffered a stroke. They needed an air ambulance to a hospital, as well as treatment and airfare home, expenses that were not covered by their health insurer. In the end, the medical expenses covered by their travel insurer were over $70,000. And the consumer was also reimbursed for trip interruption. The premium for this plan was only $70.
Wow. Representative Elkins.
Travel insurance is a unique insurance product, not only because it contains insurance and non-insurance components, but also because of how it is sold. Every travel insurance transaction ultimately involves a licensed insurer and producer, but it is often a travel agent, airline, or cruise line that is offering the travel insurance product to customers. House File 3766, which is based on a National Association of Insurance Commissioners model, provides a regulatory framework that addresses the unique aspects of travel insurance. Specifically, the bill provides important consumer protections and clarifies the responsibilities to the consumer of every entity involved in the sale. Our testifier will provide more detail in a moment. To date, 41 other states have enacted a version of the Model Act, and 7 more are considering it this year. Vice Chair Perryman has spoken with the Department of Commerce, and they are neutral on the bill, and we know of no opposition.
Thank you. And Mr. DeHaas, if you would go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Co-Chair O'Driscoll and Cagle. My name is, and members of the House Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. My name is Duke DeHaas. I'm Vice President, Deputy General Counsel of AGA Service Company, which is part of Allianz, located in Richmond, Virginia. I'm very happy I jumped the gun. I'm not here to testify on cryptocurrency, about which I learned a lot, but know almost nothing. So I'm going to stick to what I know, hopefully.
You're welcome to come back and discuss it again.
Thank you. I'm also co-chair of the Law and Reg Committee of the U.S. Travel Insurance Association. And just for your information, USTIA's members include insurance carriers, third-party administrators, insurance agencies, and related businesses in the development, administration, and sale of travel insurance and travel assistance products. Allianz is a writer of travel insurance and has an insurance company as well as a fully licensed travel insurance producer authorized to do business in all 50 states, including Minnesota. Thank you for bringing HF number 3766 before the committee today. Thank you to the sponsors. This legislation is important both for travel insurance consumers and the industry. Travel insurance is a unique product within the industry because it contains both insurance and non-insurance elements, and because it's often offered by a travel agent, airline, et cetera, not by a licensed insurance agent. That's why it is critical that each entity involved in providing travel insurance clearly understands their responsibilities to the consumer and that consumers understand how to use the product. HF 3766 provides this clarity for all involved in the transaction. Legislation also builds upon existing licensing and regulatory structures in place in Minnesota by adding new consumer protections. These protections include, for example, a free look period for refunds, important disclosures such as how to file a claim and who the consumer should contact if they need assistance, and a prohibition of illusory insurance, which is a policy that due to exclusions and other provisions does not provide meaningful coverage. Legislation will also expand consumer choice and availability of travel insurance products in Minnesota by defining and providing for eligible groups through which travel insurance products can be sold on a group or blanket basis. This would permit, for example, a group of students attending the University of Minnesota or church members going on a group missions trip to be covered by the same travel insurance policy purchased by the university or church. Finally, the bill standardizes definitions and provides a clear roadmap for how the travel insurance product is to be filed with the department, which should assist in providing new and improved travel insurance products for consumers while also including strong consumer protections in the bill. We thank you for your time and consideration, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. DeHaas. And Mr. Smith, I know you're not on the testifying list, but you were referenced in here as the department having a neutral position. I just did ask you if you would like to testify this morning. Okay. He has given me a verbal indication from the audience he is not interested in testifying. Mm-hmm. So we'll let the statement made by Mr. DeHaas as the department being neutral as that, based on his reaction. Is there any members of the public present today that would like to testify on House File 3766, which is before the committee this morning? Anyone from the public wishing to testify on 3766, the matter of travel insurance, before the committee? Seeing none and hearing none, members, questions? We'll start with Representative Hewitt, followed by Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is a great bill, and I'm concerned. I've been actually involved in these evacuations of patients from other countries, and I'm surprised you only found a $70,000 bill. Because it's right now, I know that back in the day, and that was over 10 years ago, that we had like a $300,000 bill because we had to pay the hospital bill before we took the patient. We had to do all the critical care because the standards are different in each country before we put these people in an airplane. So my question, and that's more of a statement, but my question is, will this still make it affordable for the common person? Because My concern is, like, I buy travel insurance because I can't afford to pay $300,000 tomorrow. So is this still going to be affordable? I don't know who to answer that, Chair.
I think we'll probably start with Mr. DeHaas, since he's probably got closer firsthand industry knowledge on that. Mr. DeHaas.
So, Chair O'Driscoll, thank you. Thank you for the question. So, yeah, that story from...
My pleasure.
Sorry. The story that you heard about is a news article or newscast from New York. It's not a Minnesota resident, but it's a little dated, so it's a few years ago. But the price was, they paid $70 for the policy. They had a stroke. The plane had to be retrofitted. It was a Lufthansa jet. You seem familiar with these issues. They had to have a nurse fly back with them. I don't know why the bill was only $70,000, actually, because I've heard air ambulance bills being north of you know, six figures. But in that case, it was $70,000 that was paid by our company. As far as the affordability overall, so the general cost of a travel insurance product is typically 5 to 8% of your overall trip if you buy the travel insurance product. That has been basically the same for 20 years. Maybe slight uptick post-pandemic. People are now covering some COVID-19 type things, and there's some built-in cost to that. But the product has essentially been stable. The way it would bring down prices potentially is more availability, more people coming into the market, which hopefully would happen if you enact the model legislation. As far as costs or caps on emergency medical, I guess it's complicated. The way our company deals with it is essentially you need to be going through somebody we've approved or communicated with. Doesn't always happen, and doesn't mean it's not going to be covered, but we try to force that on the front end, and that is what helps keep some of those costs down, is that those companies are negotiating with us and we're approving that. So nuanced answer, I guess, to your question, maybe not a direct reduction of costs, but that would be the goal. As more companies are doing that, there's more folks who are sort of brought into the network, so to speak.
Representative, you have a follow-up?
No, thank you, Chair, and I think that answers the question again with the concerns of affordability for the average man. So thank you. Average people.
Average consumer, right?
Yes.
There we go. Representative Smith, then followed by Representative Katizwa-Toon. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. An interesting part of the travel insurance market, I guess, currently is that a lot of the travel credit cards have been getting into this space where premium credit cards just offer travel insurance as part of their perks, which I think is a little odd in one sense. But I want to connect that to another issue, which is a lot of companies also use traveler's insurance or connected insurance kind of as a way to get a fee. At the end of a purchase, you rent a vehicle, and then at the end it says you need insurance, right? And you may already be covered, whether by other insurance you have for your car, or, as I said, you have something on your credit card, or you have traveler's insurance in another direction. As far as the requiring important disclosures, I'm really happy to say that this allows for refunds if people find out they were already covered and paid something and didn't need to pay it. Can you talk to me about disclosures around allowing consumers to know if they already have traveler's insurance but they don't know about it, whether through a credit card or some other policy?
So, Representative Smith, just for clarification, like you might have something on your credit card or other kinds of things, that what you're looking at for a disclosure to consumers? I'm not quite sure what the question is.
Yeah, I would say a large area of the market for traveler's insurance is trying to get people to purchase it many times when they are already covered. And I think the authors are trying to make sure that doesn't happen with these disclosures and other things. But I was curious specifically in the area of credit cards, if that's something that you have looked at in this bill.
Mr. DeHaas, do you have any experience with that for Representative Smith?
Sure. Chair O'Driscoll, thanks for the question. Representative Smith, right? Okay.
You're usually pretty good at this stage.
Just guess Smith, you'll be all right. Yeah.
Your odds are in my favor on that one. Yeah. But no, I appreciate the question. I think, you know, the disclosures are important, what's in this model. To your point about maybe overinsurance, I think, if that's your question, I it's a fair point. I think a lot of folks probably don't know what credit card benefits they have or utilize them. One thing I will say for our company, we try to distinguish the product that we are offering. Credit card benefits, typically it's, you know, It's part of what you get if you get your credit card. They're not getting substantial emergency medical a lot of times, right? It's going to be the bare bones stuff. When I go to rent a car and you're offered collision and damage protection, which is different from liability coverage, that's a travel insurance product, and I turn it down because my auto insurance company already has something that I think is sufficient for that. Maybe I shouldn't say that since my company offers the product. We think there's value to it. But you can overload consumers also with disclosures, I think. I guess I just want to add that. If you try to get too much into this but not that, in many cases you're going to confuse the consumer. So one thing I will just add as far as the consumer protections, if the consumer is actually wanting to dig into, do I already have this, and they are buying this at a travel from a travel agency or on an airline booking path, and they say, what about my health insurance? Does this already cover this? They won't get the answer there because the legislation requires, and you have this in your limited lines model, 60K383, that's already in existence, what a licensed producer can do versus a travel retailer. There will be a number or a link or something, so the consumer has to go to a licensed producer to get that answer. So maybe not as much disclosures as there could be for all circumstances, but that's the goal sort of the bill, is to provide the information at point of sale and then distinguish between what a licensed producer is able to answer and what a retailer is able to respond to.
Representative Smith, follow-up?
Yeah, I really appreciate that answer because I agree that disclosures are not always helpful, especially because folks who are on vacation don't want to read 6 pages of disclosures that are at 10 font.
They got to do something on the airplane.
Yeah, I guess. But usually not at the rental car company. Usually then you want to get to the condo or whatever. I think the problem is we've allowed too many of these companies to offer these services at the point of sale too often. And I'm not talking about your company particularly. I think actually, you know, your companies are good actors in the space trying to provide group insurance or those things to people who are taking a particular thing. So I just wanted to focus in, as we're talking about travel insurance, consumers are inundated with fees all the time on the internet as they are buying things. They need this and they need that. And it's our job not just to provide them education, but to provide them some protection from predatory fees. And I think at times travel insurance can be that, not from a licensed provider or good actors in the space, but from when we're allowing companies like rental car companies, or we're allowing companies, even like credit card companies, to get involved in this space at the same time. I think that's something we should take seriously in this committee. So thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Before I get to our next member question, which is going to be Representative Katiza Watun, I just want to follow up, and I believe I know the answer to this question. In order to activate those benefits on a credit card, you must use that particular credit card, I'm sure, to make the purchase, right? So if you're going to a travel agent and you're buying a package for 10 days on a cruise or whatever, and it happens to be $12,000, you'd have to have purchased that $12,000 package on that card in order to activate the benefits. And the problem sometimes is people will split cards or they'll do different things and they end up with no coverage or limited coverage. Am I correct on that assessment, Mr. DeHaas?
Yes, Chair O'Driscoll, exactly. Great point. I neglected to mention that, but that is exactly true. If you don't purchase it on that credit card, you're not going to have coverage at all through that. And if you only purchase a portion of it, some of it may be covered, some of it maybe not. And if I could just add one other thing, there's also a consumer protection in the bill for prohibition on opt-out sales. Okay, so to your point, Representative Smith, consumers are inundated with information, at least I feel that way, trying to make choices, at least in this legislation. No one is going to be allowed to have to, they're not going to have to uncheck a box to make sure they don't get stuck with something, and then they have to take advantage of the free look period to get rid of it. Somebody has to make an affirmative decision to make the purchase before it is included in their bill.
Representative Katiza Watun is withdrawing her question. Then it brings us to Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is in regards to kind of following up on Representative Hewitt's comments about overall cost. You know, this is a broader issue than I'd given much thought to travel insurance. You know, my familiarity with travel insurance is I book a flight, I'm going somewhere, and I want to insure for, you know, my flight's $500 or whatever, and I want to have a little insurance to cover it and have a little more option. I am concerned for consumers that
Can you give some a little more clarification that has some of the major players, some of the airlines been involved in any of this discussion? Are they concerned about costs going up? Can you just give a little more little highlight on that?
Mr. DeHaas.
Chair O'Driscoll, thank you for the question. So a couple of things I guess it's important to remember. So we are heavily regulated. Department of Commerce, all 50 states. We love the state-based system of regulation. We think it's very important in consumer protections. Our rates and forms are all filed with the state departments, okay? Now, in most states, there's no prior approval. They're not necessarily looking, but we get plenty of objections. We get questions about expenses, commissions, how are we justifying consumer value through what we file. Some states are more active than others, but that's sort of step number one, is those things are established by the state, and we have to get those approved. Secondly, to your point, and maybe this goes to Representative Smith's question a little bit too, while I agree that consumers are often inundated with information and maybe they just don't want to have to be dealing with it, it's an established fact that consumers are thinking about travel insurance when they're buying a trip. And so that's why the opportunity typically occurs when they're making that purchase. The take rates are low. I guess I don't want to necessarily reveal what our companies are, but we'd make a lot more money if 50 to 60% of people decide to check yes instead of no at point of sale. It's a much lower number than that. And maybe plenty of good reasons. If I'm flying to Europe, I might buy travel insurance. If I'm flying back to Richmond, Virginia today, maybe not. So the other way that the price is very sensitive is that simple fact is if the price is above what I said, which is typically 5 to 8%, it's just not purchased. So I'm not going to say the market necessarily works, but there's all kinds of ways to buy it. So one last thing I'll say is if you're in a booking path, and you decide, you know what, I don't like that company. Why is Allianz always in the Delta site? I don't want that. I want Generali or I want Zurich or some other carrier. You click one window and open it, and you can go to an aggregator site, InsureMyTrip, SquareMouth, and get your choices and decide I'm going to price shop here and it's not worth it. So, or I will get it from another carrier. So sorry for the long answer, but hopefully that gets
you. Representative Finsberg, in follow-up?
Nope, thank you.
All right, Representative Elkins.
Yeah, I just relate my own recent experience. So, Representative Smith's kind of on a roll today in terms of asking illuminating questions. So, I 90% of the time I don't check the box. But I had a vacation in January with a tour operator who required it. And probably because at this destination we could be expected to encounter saltwater crocodiles, sharks, and poisonous sea snakes. But in any case...
Were you filming an episode of Survivor?
Episode 10 of Survivor was filmed at this destination. I ended up, just booking it when I, along with my Delta flights. And it was, for the first time ever, I checked the yes box and ended up with one of these guys' policies. I mean, it even comes up with this nifty app, actually, in case you need to exercise the benefits. But the cost was reasonable. It did offer peace of mind. And in this case, I thought it was good value. Fortunately, I did not need to take advantage of it. And to Representative Smith's point, I mean, I'm a Medicare member, and so I shop for plans every year, and that's one of the things I look at frequently. Your medical plan will also provide travel coverage as well, so that's another place to look before you think yes.
Very good. Seeing no other member questions, and Representative Elkins, it kind of sounded like part of a wrap-up on that. We'll give you a chance to see if there's anything else, and then we'll go to Representative Perryman, and then we'll lay the bill over, again, pending the outcome of if there is or isn't a fiscal note that we have to deal with in this committee on that bill. Representative Perryman.
Thank Chair Wiskel and members for listening to the bill today. Yes, Representative Smith, you do enlighten with your questions, so thank you. It gets us all to understand more that we things we may not think of. You must be a very well-traveled individual that used crypto, and I think you use X. What else? I know you're very involved with a lot of things. Lobbyists tell me that. So thank you. And I want to just thank everyone again for listening to our bill. And with that...
Well, Representative Smith, did you use crypto to buy travel insurance with your private key from your credit union?
At a kiosk.
Very good. Okay. Well, now we got that clarified. And with that, seeing no other business on House File 3766, we will lay that over. And that concludes our business for today. And tomorrow, the committee will be meeting again. And I'm going to toss it over to Co-Chair Kegel for a preview for tomorrow's meeting. Representative and Co-Chair Kegel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tomorrow we'll be hearing just two bills, but they should be good ones. Surveillance price gouging. Both of them will have components of that, and so it should be exciting.
Thank you. And seeing no other business before the committee, we are adjourned.